Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Before we dive into the main part of the show, which we're going to talk about how love clothes the human being or makes him completely naked, I wanted to review a little bit of the story about Ask It. And I'll tie this into our topic today. Now, this first contact with Billy and Ask It took place on February 3rd of 1953. And interestingly, I just noticed today that this contact report was not even translated into 2009. My radio show, I think, started in 2010, so it's very interesting how this whole series of events, one depends on another in terms of happening. I couldn't have started my radio show any earlier, is what I'm saying. Kind of off topic, but I thought that was very, very interesting. So I think Billy is close to 16 years old at this time, 15 or 16 years old. And he's climbed up on top of a hill where he was told he would meet his second mentor, Ask It. So Billy's already had 11 years of mentoring by an extraterrestrial named Svoth. Svoth was extremely old. He was almost 1,000 years old. He was nearing his death. So Billy was told he'd get this second mentor, and he just climbed up on the top of this hill. It's a cold evening in Switzerland, and it says here, in spite of the sharp cold, I broke out in a sweat as I climbed the small hill on which the agreed place was situated. Arriving there, I did not have to wait long for some sort of thing which was still supposed to come there. Because arriving on the dome of the hill, I immediately saw a bright light plunge down from the sky and set down not far from me on the hard frozen ground. And the bright light went out and I saw a matte silver and discus shaped object which stood majestically on three landing spheres and appeared to wait for me. The disc's landing spheres were completely foreign to me because I had never seen such things with this kind of form before. And the next thing Billy gets is a telepathic invitation from Ask It. And he's lifted up into this ship as if by ghostly hands, the same kind of thing that used to happen when Svoth would pull him up into the ship. And he's in the ship, decides to sit at this comfortable armchair, and then suddenly the bright light, which came from everywhere in the interior of the ship, suddenly went out, and then suddenly he seemed to be sitting outdoors. He couldn't see anything of the ship, and he was not even able to see his own left hand, which he pulled up in front of his eyes. The entire ship and myself had simply quite suddenly become invisible. And then he hears Ask It's voice in his head. And she gave him this explanation. And then, still invisible in the ship, he starts to move again, and this time he's moving eastward, and increasing speed, he's shot high into the sky, whereby a feeling some kind of, without any kind of discomfort or pleasure, or pressure, excuse me. And he moved higher and higher and higher. Now, one of the things I must have skipped over here is he did at one point, the ship slowly moved over and hovered above his home, which I thought was the most interesting thing. Anyway, let me pick up here. It says, it was without a doubt, I was in outer space, very high on the daytime side above the earth, which I still only saw is the blue, white, greenish ball. So the Earth is a ball. It is a sphere, according to my information. I know there's some flat earthers out there. That's fine. I'm not here to refute that in any way, shape, or form. I prefer people to think outside the box, and I don't want to attack people's independent thinking. But indeed, it was actually no ball. And they say, oh, it's not a ball, rather only part of a ball. Well, it's in the shaded area because now it suddenly looked like the moon, and it was half full. In shooting through empty space, I saw very far in the east a gigantic luminescent disk positioned in outer space. So I don't know if at this point he's seeing Askew's ship or not. Indeed, oh no, he's seeing the sun, it says. Indeed, that had to have been the sun, which already illuminated part of the earth on this side. And I thereby discerned a gigantic area which must have been the Indian Ocean. So he's up high above the earth, and he's looking at the sun. He's seeing the Indian Ocean, and I'm just wondering if he sees little reflections on the Indian Ocean. That's what I'm picturing. Immediately after that, in a westerly direction, it adjoined dim contours which spread out into the dense darkness. It was still deep night in the west, while far in the east, the day was already awakened and was advancing westward. So Billy's seeing a shadow on the part of the earth. He's seeing the part of the earth where it's daylight or dawn. And this is, if he sees the Indian Ocean, he sees the sun, he sees a glorious picture. And he describes it this way, is that the ship must have been traveling at tremendous speed, because he said it this way: I only could enjoy this glorious picture for a few minutes. Short minutes, which seemed like seconds to me, as suddenly everything around me began to glow dimly and my vision blurred. Then the ship and I were suddenly visible again, and I could again discern everything in the bright light of the interior of the ship. And the entrance for the ship opened, and evidently the ship had gently floated and landed on the earth. So he's walked out of the ship. He noticed he's in a country called Jordan. And then he sees something luminous in the sky as big as the moon, and this is Askew's ship, which moved at a terrific speed and became bigger all of a sudden, and then simply stood in the air, just stopped, about 80 to 100 meters up, without transition and without prior deceleration. The object appeared to simply remain hanging in the air, and then it sank slowly down to the earth, lightly and safely. He described it as a feather on an invisible thread without any sound. It was like a gigantic feather coming down and away, and then hit soundlessly. It sat down on the earth, and he had to wait for like a half an hour until Askew slowly came out. Now, this is a story I've talked about many times before, and it seems like every time I read it, I get new information out of it, which is the stunning way the Meyer material works. Now listen to what it says here. It says, she approached me in a familiar way, and I suddenly perceived an enormous loving sympathy, which somehow penetrated me in a peculiar, painful way. Now this is interesting, because I wonder why she felt sympathy, because at this point, Billy hasn't lost his left arm or anything, but she must because she's in a higher, more advanced civilization, have a sense of the difficulty of a very advanced spirit form that's 9.6 billion years old is living now in a much less advanced and developed society. And let me continue here. It says, the perception was so very familiar to me that it was able to cause painful feelings in me because I had indeed missed her in my earthly existence until now. Now, here again is a very interesting clue. Billy has missed someone that he's never met before. And he was able to have these painful feelings. He's missing, I had indeed missed her in my earthly existence until now. So he knew her from lives, I assume, on other worlds, in previous lives. Askit's somewhat peculiar greeting ceremony struck me as strangely familiar and known, yet with the best of will, I was unable to find out why she seemed so familiar and known to me. And with a later question regarding this, Askit only smiled and explained that I should consider my other personalities in earlier lives before the current one. I found this somewhat secretive and wanted to know more, yet Askit admitted nothing more about it. Now, Billy talks about Askit's clothing being different than Svoth's, and that she was dressed in such a way that she appeared as a very modern angel. And she wore a dress, which to me is bizarre. I can't imagine. Here's a woman in a spacecraft suddenly walking out in a dress. It's whitish silver, belted at the hip. She has long brunette hair, which fell over her shoulders. He described her face as very beautiful. She didn't look supernatural. She looked human and beautiful. But he, again, describes her as almost looking like a futuristic angel. And he mentions that in religious texts, he's sure that she would have been described as an angel. So after the greeting, of course, she's just a human being from a more advanced society. So he ends up getting in the ship, and they zoom high in the sky, and then he's seeing the Earth, and he sees the Mediterranean Sea, and the ship crosses over the sea, and he's able to discern the gigantic pointed structures below him, which are the pyramids. And the ship plummets down into Egypt to the pyramids of Giza. And he didn't know why he was going there. And now the sinking became a gentle floating. The ship's moving down to the Great Pyramid, where I had a very well in my memory from many pictures, the Pyramid of Giza. I recognized it by the gigantic animal human which stood as a statue not far from the Great Pyramid. And we sank towards the animal human object, the Sphinx. And Billy talks about the enormous size of the Sphinx. And he says here, because I had never seen it before, at least not in my current personality in life. So, and then he tells the whole story about Askit putting a device on his belt, and which makes him invisible. And Billy then walks over to a woman's tent, and he goes inside this woman's tent, and he ends up kissing these women, and they think he's an angel again, and they're passing out and all this, and Askett sends him telepathic information, kind of laughing. Askett said that my fears were unfounded because she had checked the woman's thoughts and ascertained that they had all become very happy in these few minutes because they had arrived at the view that they had been kissed by an invisible angel. So Askett grasps Billy, and they go down into a small entrance opening in the pyramid. Through these long, musty passageways, they travel through what's called, they call Egyptian darkness or pitch darkness. Then they see this light, and they see a giant squared stone somewhere deep in the pyramid, which they call a gigantic ashlar, which dissolved into nothing. And Askett pulls him into the opening that was created, and Billy sees two oddly clothed men, and the gigantic ashlar appears, and Askett's voice whispers in his consciousness that he should be mute and not try to speak, because we are in a place which was not constructed by her race, and it additionally would not even be slightly useful if we were to be identified here and uncovered by the guards. The guards we saw are members or are related to a power-conscious extraterrestrial group who, by certain impure means, force a majority of Earth humanity under their control in order to bring the Earth under their control. So these are people that are not functioning under the law of love, the law of true love. They're called the Giza Intelligences, and they were on the Earth until the 1970s, and they were creating a control structure to bring all the people of the Earth under their control. So Askett and Billy go deeper and deeper down, and they get to a gigantic hall where the light seems to come from everywhere and nowhere. And in this giant-sized hall was a gigantic disc-shaped spaceship, which rested here next to the various smaller ships in the middle of the hall, deep below the surface of the Earth. Billy sees a gigantic spaceship below the foundation walls of the pyramid, and then he decides to pinch himself two or three times to make sure that he's not dreaming. So he's sunk into an astonished contemplation of this ship, but he didn't get to stay there very long because Askett, I guess, got his attention, and they arrived at this small plateau, and Billy goes into an astonished state again. And on this plateau laid an ancient, large, and very heavy wooden Y-shaped cross with rusty things sitting next to it, hand-forged nails. And there was a brownish black coating on the nails. Was it blood, he says, in his mind. He saw, was it perhaps blood like the brownish black coating on three different positions on the wooden cross? He says, it must indeed have been so, because right next to these things lay an ancient wreath wound many times with abnormally big thorns, on which the red-brown coating was likewise recognizable. He saw a crown of thorns, and he saw a purple cape, a wooden rod, and these glass pearl or glass stones. And he says here, it was unmistakable. Here I stood before Christ, respectively Emmanuel's crucifixion utensils. I simply had to have been so and nothing else. It was not even able to imagine another possibility. Here I stood before everything that was connected with the death of Emmanuel, alias Jesus Christ. And the glassy stones in the leather pouch were not stones, rather certain precious stones, whose sense and purpose, however, I was not able to fathom. Mute and moved, I stood there before this witness of an ancient time which had been of worldwide significance for a very large part of humanity. Then it says, mute and moved, I looked at the things laying there and sent a grateful quick prayer to heaven that I, of all people, was permitted to see everything here. And I thereby quite forgot the words of Svath, who had said to me once that the Christian religion is just as much an irresponsible, evil, poor piece of work for this stupefaction and enslavement of the humans as are all terrestrial religions. And I inserted the word once there, but it's not in the text. Still, who would have blamed me that I, as the son of a Protestant Christian family, could simply not think of deception where Jesus Christ was spoken of? Kind of hard to believe that Billy is also dealing with his own religious programming at this point. And it says, in spite of being strongly religiously influenced, so the boy, the young boy here, is very religiously influenced, I could simply and easily loosen myself from these things laying here, which were pregnant with history. He could not loosen himself, because right here are actually laying the crucifixion utensils, which had to have been testified as evidence for the accuracy of certain things of the New Testament. And then Billy remembers Svath's words that everything is only meant to be a deception, that Jesus Christ should have never been called Jesus Christ, rather Emmanuel, that he was not God's son, and that God is not creation. Only, why had Svath told me such things? Because here before me lay indeed at least evidence to the contrary that certain things were indeed the truth. Now, I simply no longer understood anything. What was now the actual truth then? And ask it must have fully registered my thought dilemma, because she gripped me by the arm and pulled me along with her the same way back that we had come before, whereby I could still observe various things. We strode past the two guards, who took no initiative against us at all. And again, the heavy giant squared stone dissolved into nothing. We stepped through the opening, and it obviously led back through the same passageway. And suddenly, we stepped out of the dark pyramid again. And I saw the Sphinx and our ship. And then I already sat in my armchair, and we shot toward the sky at crazy speed. I realized only vaguely that the Bedouin camp had disappeared and that many foreign people were going around the pyramid. Tourists. It was interesting. There were tourists there. They didn't see Asket's ship because it was cloaked. I skipped over that. And the sun was already very high in the sky, and I noticed something unbelievable. I had not been in the pyramid for only a very short time, but rather I had been there many hours, although to me the time appeared to be minutes. The ship with Asket and me raced back with unimaginable speed and sat down on the same place from where it had started. the flight to the pyramids deep in the desert mountains of the Jordanian countryside, and the ship, lay there more than two full days while Askin instructed me in very many things and also provided me with many explanations. It was for me 2 days of wonder, joy, recognition, learning, and the acceptance of a mission. So Billy is accepting his mission at this point, and I kind of went off on a gigantic tangent there, but I'll try to connect these two, and I'll take a very short break. We're going to listen to our clip of the birds chirping and singing, and then we'll come back and put these different loosely fitting factors together. And I'll be right back, folks. Okay, folks, welcome back. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics, and I just, on a whim more or less, went over the story of Askit and Billy far below the Giza Plateau in the Great Pyramid. And I thought I would read a little bit about some of the things that Emmanuel, and I have the old version of the Talmud of Emmanuel, so this has bad translations and all, but I thought I would read a few of the things that Emmanuel said. It says here, look at the birds in the sky. They do not sow, they do not reap, they do not gather into the barns, and yet creation feeds them. The term creation is the term that the Meyer folks, the Meyer writings, use for describing the superintelligence that is evolving our universe and that created our universe. They say that this intelligence is not human. It is not. It doesn't even have a personality. It's not a heavenly father. It radiates love. It operates across trillions and trillions of years in these stages of evolution. But yet, what's interesting here, it says about the birds, that they do not sow, they do not reap, they do not gather in the barns, and yet creation feeds them, which is very, very interesting. So there's this, it says that love is the highest principle in all creation, and through it everything exists in absolute logic. So creation, this super intelligence, the spiritual energy that's really neither good nor evil in our human sense of the words, provides for the needs of the birds here. And it says, are you not much more valuable than they? Look at the birds in the sky. They wipe out harmful insects and they have plumage for clothing. They work because they carry out their duty and they are fed and clothed by creation. Are you not much more than they? Now, I skipped over a verse there because I think it has a really horrific translation I didn't want to read. I could be wrong about that, but it says here, you can think independently through your free consciousness. You can work independently, and you can independently prepare food and drink and clothe your bodies. It says here, behold the lilies in the marsh as they grow. They neither toil nor spin, yet truthfully I say to you, the lilies also fulfill their mission when they give pleasure to the eye with their beauty. I tell you, even Solomon in all his splendor was not arrayed as one of these. Creation nourishes and clothes the grass in the field, which today is living and tomorrow is thrown into the stove. Should you then not also do much more for yourselves? The grass fulfills its mission by serving as fodder and fuel. But are you not of much more value than the grass, O you of little faith? Therefore, you should care for the wisdom and the knowledge of your spirit, and take care that you do not suffer from lack of food, drink, and clothing. Truly I say unto you, if you suffer from hunger, thirst, and nakedness, then wisdom and knowledge will be crowded out by worry. First seek the realm of your spirit and its knowledge, then seek to comfort your body with food, drink, and clothing. Therefore, take care for the next day, for tomorrow will not take care of you by itself. It is enough that each day has its own cares, so that you should not have to worry about your physical welfare. Very, very interesting words from Emmanuel. And this is how Billy learned about the big distinction between what the Meyer material says happened at that time. So either it's all a lie and it's a horrible blasphemy, or we have been given a false narrative. So I just let people make the choice. Let people make the judgment for themselves. Now, I'm back in a book called The Way to Live. And this book is written by Edward Albert Meyer. I was reading about the story of Emmanuel. Supposedly, Meyer information says, the spirit form that incarnated as Emmanuel 2,000 years ago is the same spirit form that writes the following words that I'm going to read for you. It said, the love clothes the human being or makes him completely naked. What does that mean? Well, there are two kinds of love. There's an effective love that's based on a reverence. True love is based on reverence and respect. But there's a false love that's more romantic and it's artificial and it's based on emotion. So the love clothes the human being. That's the effective love. That's the love based on reverence, or it makes him completely naked. The love based on emotion will make you completely naked. Now, Liebe, L-I-E-B-E, is the German word for love. And love can be defined as an intense feeling of deep affection. My translations are, excuse me, my pronunciation is often weak when it comes to the German. I am certainly not a German expert. We're trying to slowly move in that direction. Nackt is the German word that means bare, naked, stripped, completely naked. All of Billy's books are written originally in German, so we get a translation. We are not talking about having no clothes on here. Rather, we are talking about being completely exposed in terms of your feelings, your intentions, and your thoughts. And this is kind of an analogy. Love clothes the human being. True love, effective love, artificial romantic love makes him completely naked. In this case, naked means devoid of concealment or disguise, like the naked truth, or another saying, naked aggression. Bare, naked, nude, bald, barren means deprived of naturally or conventionally appropriate covering. Bare implies the removal of what is additional, superfluous, ornamental, or dispensable. For example, an apartment with bare walls. Naked suggests the absence of protective or ornamental covering. Now, I thought this was important. Naked, the term naked, can also imply a state of nature, a destitution, a defenselessness. So this romantic love can make you completely defenseless. And that it exposes you in terms of your feelings, your intentions, and your thoughts. So with that in mind, you may not want to engage in romantic love in that sense, or focus on being neutral, positive as much as possible in any romantic love that you have. Contact Report 10, it says, the earth human speaks of a love that he does not know. He believes he knows that his sentiments are love, and through this he deceives himself. Love cannot be clothed in words because it is, just as happiness is, a state and not a place. True love is imperishable, and nothing is able to change it into something else. So if you're functioning under effective love, love based on reverence, it will be completely stable. You'll trust it. You'll trust in it. You won't feel instability in your thoughts from that kind of love. Page 58 in The Might of Thoughts in the book called The Way to Live is where I am right now. And there is an artificial love, though. So we're contrasting true love with artificial love. Let me read again here. It says, the love clothes the human being or makes him completely naked. It cleanses him or her or makes him dusty in order to then immediately let him or her freeze in the cold or warm in the heat. In the love, the human being is like a grain which is threshed. That doesn't sound very good to me. I don't know about you, but if that's romantic love, if that's where artificial love leads us, I don't really want to experience too much of that. Sifted and freed from the chaff to then be ground into a meal and then kneaded until supple, after which the controlled heat raises the leavening. So now you're baking in an oven and bakes a loaf of bread, which as a work of love nourishes all. So Billy's, there's a lot here that it's going to take a lot of time to sort out all of this. But I believe what he's doing here mostly is contrasting artificial love with a universal love that's based on reverence, respect, and is very stable. Unfortunately, the human being... Oh, let me back up here. Yet much more comes forth for the human being from this love so that he gets to know the true love and makes it his or her own in himself and his or her life. Unfortunately, the human being often only searches for love out of anxiety or to find calmness, pleasure, or gratification. Okay, if you're searching for love to solve problems like anxiety and or to give you calmness or for pleasure or for gratification, however, this is the wrong way and the wrong form of love, which is only artificially created in order to fulfill emotional or lustful wishes. And we're programmed by society to search for this wrong form of love, which is emotional and lustful. In this form of love, it is better for the human being if he covers the nakedness of his or her greed and searches for the true value of love. That's a humbling statement. In order to find the way out of his or her world without seasons, which only conveys monotony. So I think some people have monotonous lives that they want to free themselves from, and they search for love to do that. And in which he or she laughs without being able to enjoy it. So I think people, they get into a state where they are alienated from themselves and they cannot even, their own emotions do not provide for them any release. So let me repeat this. It says, and which he or she laughs without being able to enjoy it, and in which he or she cries without shedding tears, which would bring him or her a release. And now we're told what true love is. True love is a concentrated form of fine spiritual perception and is not built on emotions. Because truthfully, it is fine spiritual perception itself. Therefore, love itself is only power. Wow. Love itself is only power. So that's true love there. Love itself is only power. And it never takes anything which would not be of itself. Love does not allow itself to be possessed because the love also does not possess. Because it is the purest fine spiritual perception and is sufficient in itself. So true love doesn't leave you wanting something. So where artificial love, you're always longing. You're longing to be with the person that gives you all of this stimulation and happiness. How long can that remain real, right? The love is not located in the heart, and it is not the power of a god. Rather, it is the purest, fine spiritual perception of the spirit. And this is the part that's hard to define. It's called Empfinden in the German. It's a purely spiritual process of your spiritual consciousness. And I always say, observing nature is the closest that I can get to defining this. And of consciousness of the human being who creates it in him or herself by means of fine spiritual perception. The truthfully love is a form of fine spiritual perception. It is all embracing, and this is a clue for you if you're trying to understand this. It's never fickle. So if you're in a relationship where the other side is very fickle, they do not love you in this reverent love. And if you are loving in a way that's fickle, if you see inconsistency in yourself, then you're not loving in terms of true love. So true love is absolutely indestructible. It is creational, it is natural, and it cannot be impaired by anything, bad habits and negative evil powers, etc. Now here's another thing I'm trying to wrap my mind around. It says, truly, the true love is not direct, not to be directed. While it, however, as the creationally naturally highest factor of all life and logic, directs the human being in dignity. So, and this doesn't mean that your opposite member's manipulating you in any way. And if they are, then that's not true love. Rather, you are kind of being internally guided in love to help, to provide for, to be a companion of a person, an animal, a plant. And you're fulfilling you're directed in that sense. You're not directing love. And there's also logic associated with love. So let's continue here. While it, however, as the creational, naturally highest factor of all love and logic, directs the human being in dignity during the course of his or her life. This is not the case with the false love, which results from emotions and drives this artificial love, which is steered by the human being. So if you're steering this love, it's artificial, and it can have some really bad side effects. And it is always, the artificial love is steered by the human being, is directable, and indeed always according to the emotional or the libidinous wishes and thoughts. So it's always dealing with emotions and the libido, the sex drive. And here's another profound thing to try to contemplate. Maybe you can figure this out before me. It says, true love has no wishes at all. I guess that makes sense. I mean, if you're out appreciating creation and the incredible splendor of nature, which is the visible expression of the love of creation, then you have no wishes at all. In fact, appreciating the beauty of nature is completely fulfilling. And that love fulfills itself. Only the human being has wishes that he or she is always willing to fulfill. And as he or she wants to fulfill these, may he or she do this in true love. Thus, his or her main wish should not be that he becomes free of the burden of the unknowledge. In other words, let me read that again. It says, Thus, his or her main wish should be that he becomes free of the burden of the unknowledge and of the disharmony. So there's a kind of disharmony that, and an unknowledge that we are learning and we're trying to rid ourselves of. And that he or she may melt like the cold glacial ice through the glow of the sun here. And there's some kind of analogy here that Billy's drawing. And become a rushing brook which splashing pours down through the country and flows into the ocean to become one with it in loving connectedness. So maybe this is an analogy to feeling connected to creation. In love, unite with the ocean and form a oneness with it. May the wishes of the human being go there so they can capture and taste the pain of the innermost connectedness and the tenderness of love, to be wounded by their own understanding of the love and to joyfully bear the profound pain of love. So perhaps, I don't know, he may be talking about artificial love again there. Now here's a, I'm going to read this last passage on love, and it's kind of describing a daily preoccupation with love, with true love, I'm assuming, I'm hoping. Every morning, may the human being greet the new day with inspired love, and in waking, give the life the appropriate thanks and promise that he or she will daily contemplate the delight of true love. So we're told to daily contemplate the delight of true love. So think about the true love you have in your life, your love for creation, your love for the earth, your love for family, friends, plants, and animals. That's true love. And contemplate it. And will never rest in creating the truthfully love in himself or herself. And may the human being return home every evening, satisfied by fulfilling his or her day's work full of gratitude and love. And may the human being then go to sleep with words of love on his or her lips for the almightiness of the creation and its truthfully all-embracing love. So the all-embracing love is coming from creation itself. Boy, a very interesting tangent from the story of the Giza intelligence as far below the Giza plateau and that whole mystery of Egypt. According to Meyer information, the Great Pyramid was built about 73,000 years ago. And there were a group of extraterrestrial humans that I think were benevolent that planned the whole construction of this thing. And I think Earth humans and animals played a role in the actual building of this. And they built this structure for various reasons, which we've never been completely told, as far as I understand. But eventually, during the end of the Atlantis and Lemuria age, these extraterrestrials, these negative extraterrestrials, the Giza intelligence, took it over. And the fall of Atlantis and Lemuria, there was a great age before ours, actually two ages of Atlantis and Lemuria, which ended about 12,500 years ago when the Lemurians brought in an asteroid from the asteroid belt, and they put a drive on it, a electromagnetic drive and a nuclear drive, and they directed it towards the Earth at the city of Atlantis, which I believe was on an island continent in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And they brought this giant asteroid in, and it made this incredible, like a howling noise when it came in, which was, I'm sure, very spooky. And it exploded a certain number of miles up, and it rained down what was like nuclear tactical nukes all over the Earth. And it split into these two parts, these two gigantic fists, sometimes called titanic fists, I believe, that slammed into the Atlantic Ocean and hit the crust of the Earth and opened up magma that heated up the waters in the Atlantic Ocean suddenly and created a gigantic steam, for lack of a better word, that rushed high into the atmosphere, and a tidal wave occurred. The Earth listed on its axis for the first time. Atlantis was completely destroyed, and perhaps this is the initial cataclysm for the flood, I'm not sure. But it pretty much wiped out most of all of life on Earth, except for in a few places here and there where people were hanging on. And they went back into the most harshest primitive form of living. And that's where we're kind of standing right now. If we continue doing what we're doing with particularly overpopulation, and I could spend a whole show on this. I know you hear all the time people say, well, you could fit all 7 billion or 9 billion people, depending on how many you think there are, you could fit them all in 200 square miles or 300 square miles in Texas. Well, let's say you do that, and what are these 9 billion people going to eat, or 7 billion people, whatever it is? Well, are you going to allow them to eat meat? And they're probably going to want to eat meat. Well, maybe they're going to want to eat beef. So it takes about 1.6 acres of grazing space for each cow. So if there's 9 billion people, you're probably going to have over 9 billion additional acres required for those people that you stuffed in Texas. And it's more than 9 billion. If you do it right, you're going to have like 12 billion acres for just the cattle for these people to eat. And that's if one person gets a cow for their whole life. So what about if they want to eat ham, pigs, or chicken, or turkey? And then you're going to have to add on additional billions of acres for all of that. And then, oh, what if they want to eat corn? Billions of acres for that. What if they want rice? Billions of acres for that. What if they want potatoes and other vegetables? Many, many acres for that. Oh, by the way, they're going to want to live with high technology, so they're going to want to build computers, and they're going to want to build light fixtures, and oh, they're going to want to have musical instruments, and they're going to want to have microphones, and they're going to want to have microwaves, and they're going to want to have garage doors, and they're going to want to have cars, and oh, now you have to build all these factories, and pretty much you're going to be right back in a state similar to where we are now. So we're vastly overpopulated, and that's going to lead to pressures, which are going to lead to wars, which are going to lead to the potential collapse of governments. So we're hanging on the thread of where the people were at the time of Atlantis and Lemuria. And we need to understand these spiritual principles, first of all, and start to fix our gigantic overpopulation problem, which if you look around you, you'll see where the wooded places are being destroyed all over. Unless you already live in the city, then you're already living in the overpopulation. You see it in traffic every day in any major city. Just try to drive in rush hour traffic, and you'll always deal with traffic backed up for hours and hours and hours. So think about these things, and that's what this show is for to stimulate thought in people. And again, I hope you find this information to be helpful and useful. Perhaps I'm going to try to get some guests. I know people get sick of hearing me talk all the time, but there's so many important principles in the Meyer teachings. I hope you've enjoyed this. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Have a great afternoon. Thank you. Bye-bye.